Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today we have an old classic to discuss on the podcast today. I don't know when this game came out.
I thought it was older than it is. It apparently came out in 2012.
Okay. So not as old as
I guess still kind of old now because it's 2020.
Yeah, 8 years ago. But still a classic as far as I know. I'm excited to talk about it with all of you listeners and with you, Matthew, today. So Matthew, what game are we talking about?
We're discussing Terra Mystica, designed by, I'm probably going to say this wrong, correct me if I do so, but Jens Drogemüller and Helga Ostertag. And it was published in 2012 by Feuerland Spiel and won a bunch of awards like Golden Geek Game of the Year, Trick Track, Meeple's Choice, and it was also Kenner Spiel recommended.
All right. So for a short description of what Terra Mystica is about, and this time it is actually very short. In Terra Mystica, players control fantasy factions that aim to expand their territory by terraforming the landscape to their faction's preferred terrain. Each turn, players collect resources, change the landscape, build and upgrade structures, and acquire points. After six turns, the player with the most points wins. And the reason why it's so short and concise is because if I tried to get into any amount of detail with this game, then that short description would just become the full-length description of the game. So that's the short description. You're terraforming the landscape to build structures, collect resources, and earn points. But how you do that is a little more complicated than that.
All right, so where do we begin?
I guess we'll start by, first of all, like I mentioned, every player controls a faction in this game. And let's see, how many factions are there? I think there's 14.
Yeah, there's seven.
There's 14 different factions. Each faction is represented by a color, but each color represents two different factions. They're the details and the things that the players get are on these large cardboard faction cards.
Tableaus
that are dealt at the beginning of the game. So there's the green factions, the black factions, the brown factions, the gray factions, the blue factions, the red factions, and the yellow factions. 14 total. Each faction is distinguished usually by a special passive ability or triggered ability to use specific game design turns, but a specific ability, as well as specific rules for one of the structures that they build. So every faction builds the same structures, but one of those structures, which is the stronghold, which is let's call it like the third level tier of faction of structure. It's difficult to build, and each faction has different abilities associated with that stronghold in addition to just a general faction ability. So just to go over, should we go over a couple of them, give some examples? Or maybe we should talk about how the game is played.
I was going to say, I did also want to mention that the other main distinction between every faction is that there are seven different types of terrain.
Ooh, yes.
And each faction can only live and build structures on one type of terrain.
Right. So those types of terrain are mountains, wasteland, desert, farmland, swamp, wetland, and forest, as far as I could tell.
That sounds about right.
Here we go. Plains, swamp, lakes, forest, mountains, wasteland, and desert are the different. So I had a couple of them a little wrong. But yes. So seven different colors of faction. Each color of faction corresponds to a type of terrain. So mermaids and swarmlings both care about lake terrain. Chaos magicians and giants both care about wastelands, and so on and so forth. And when I say they care about them, like you may have mentioned just now, factions can only build structures on the terrain that corresponds to their faction. So the Oren and witches can only build structures on forests. At the start of the game, the board, which is divided into a number of hexagons that has some, you know, rivers running through it to separate the land into a couple different chunks or land masses, is dotted with all of the different terrains in a pattern to where no two terrain tiles are next to each other of the same kind. So there's no two forests next to each other. There's all these individual forests laid out in a pattern. And so at the start of the game, you can only build your structures on these terrains that match you, and they're spread apart. And part of this game is connecting your structures into a large terrain, or starting with one structure in a part of the board and building it out to a larger territory. And the way that you do that is by terraforming. So Matthew, why don't you describe the process of terraforming?
Right. So on your faction board, there is a little wheel that shows your faction's terrain on top, and then the other terrains around the wheel going downward. So there's three on the left, three on the right, and yours on top. And between each terrain, for every faction except I think one, there is a little shovel icon. Now, that means that when you produce shovels, you can spend them to, terraform one stage around the wheel for each shovel you produce, for each shovel it costs. So, for example, if you have mountains at the top and you have, like, wetlands and wastelands are one on each side, then those would take one shovel to turn into a mountain. But then if you have swamp and desert that are two spaces away from the mountain, or two shovels away, then it takes two shovels to turn a space from a desert or wetland into a mountain in that case.
Right. So shovels are this sort of pseudo resource that you obtain in the game, and you use them to convert terrain one stage along this wheel, the goal of which is to convert it to your terrain so that you can start to build on it. But that's not necessarily the case. Every time you earn shovels, sometimes you won't be able to have enough shovels to convert the terrain that you're trying to build on into yours terrain. So you might partially convert it. You might use a shovel to advance from a field to a swamp, but then you will still need one more shovel to advance from the swamp to a lake if you're playing, say, the mermaids. So you could partially terraform it, and then on a later turn, get that shovel to convert it the rest of the way. However, in that meantime, when you don't have a structure built there, someone else might come along and try and build on that terrain instead. So that's one of the risks in this game. Let's talk about the actions that you take in this game.
I was just going to say one more thing, is that you can only terraform spaces that are adjacent to where you have buildings.
Right. And that is adjacent, indirectly adjacent included, which is an important distinction in this game that we might get to later.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the actions that you can take in this game, because I think that'll explain most of what this game is about.
Right.
This game, and then we can also get into the details that don't get mentioned here.
You eating something?
No, I'm going through the box.
Oh, okay.
Of all the bags and finding the action card. Okay.
Cool.
So here's the actions you take on your turn. Or you can take. On your turn, you only take one action, you continue to do this until you choose not to take any more actions, or you have no ability to take any of these actions, in which case you pass, which is the eighth action that you can take. But the other seven are this. So the first action is terraform and build. So both of parts of this action are optional, but you have to do at least one for you to actually take this action. But essentially, first, you may terraform a space that is adjacent to one of your structures. And then second, you may build on that space if it is the correct terrain. We'll talk about the resources you have in this game and what you might need to build in a little bit. The second action is you can advance your shipping tracker. So essentially, if you have a territory or a structure built on a territory that is next to a river, you cannot build in the river. And if your shipping power, shipping might, I guess, isn't strong enough, then you can't build across the river or down the river either. But by upgrading your shipping power, then you can start to build across rivers and down the river. So, for example, the river is also hexagons. If you have a shipping power of one, then that means if you have something on the edge of a river, you can build something one hex away, so on the other side of the river, essentially. All right. Number three is you can increase your shoveling capabilities. So at the start of the game, it requires a number of resources to create a shovel and shovel a terrain and change it to another terrain like we described. But you can spend resources to increase that rate. So you have to spend fewer resources to change a terrain into yours. The fourth option is upgrading a building. So all factions have the same types of buildings available to them. There is one building that is the dwelling, which is kind of like the basic building, and then it upgrades into further buildings along a tree. So the fourth action is to just do that. The fifth action is to spend a priest, which is one of the resources that you get in this game, to advance on the cult tracker. This is a tracker beside the board that has four sort of lanes. There's four trackers that you can advance on. Each one corresponds to an element. So there's fire, water, earth, and wind. And you can spend a priest to advance your token on those trackers, which is important because at certain points you will acquire resources. And then at the end of the game, whoever's the furthest on those trackers and second furthest and third furthest will get bonus points. And it's a lot of bonus points. The sixth action is you can spend a resource called power to use a power action. These are six actions that can be found on the game board, and they involve collecting different kinds of resources, getting shovels, or building bridges, which is another way of crossing rivers and building things on the other side. And then the seventh action that you can take is you can use a bonus action. This is an action that has it's signified by an orange octagon, and it's found in different parts of the board. But essentially, a bonus action is just something that takes your whole turn to do, but it lets you do whatever it says. So like some factions, for example, after they build their stronghold, will gain access to a bonus action that might let them build a dwelling somewhere on the board or upgrade a structure.
These bonus actions, by the way, are only possible to do once per round.
Right.
And in the case of the actions on the board that you spend power for, if one person does it, then nobody else can for that round.
Right. Those actions have the same orange octagon symbol to represent them, which means that it can only be used once. After that action is used, you take a little octagon with an X on it to cover it up to show that it's been used. And then the last action, like we mentioned, is passing. And when you pass, you get to trade out what is called a bonus card for another one. And bonus cards are things that will give you bonus resources or points during a turn. There's enough bonus cards so that there's always three extra after everyone has picked one during a game. And so the eighth action is you end your turn, you exchange your bonus card for a new one, and then you wait for everyone else to pass so that the next round can start. So those are the eight actions you take. Most importantly, ones to remember and keep in mind are the terraform and build, the upgrade your structure. Those are kind of key. And then the rest are just kind of ancillary to those things.
Though I will say, make sure to remember that you can send your priest on a mission.
Yes, on a mission to increase your standing with a cult.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the resources now.
Right.
There are, four resources in this game.
Sure.
Three of them function very similarly. One of them is a little more unique. So the first resource, the one that you first encounter and the one that your dwellings produce, is workers. And these are signified by little white cubes. Every game, you start with a number of workers, and then you start with a number of dwellings on the board, which will produce more workers on the first turn of the game. And then as you build more dwellings, you will then acquire more workers at the beginning of every round. And workers are used to do pretty much every action in the game, except increasing your shipping power, and also except power actions, because those only take power to perform.
But
they're used to build dwellings and to upgrade your structures and to upgrade your shovels.
And produce shovels.
Workers are the exactly. Workers are the resource that you must spend to make shovels. If you do not have them from other means. So if you wish to terraform a territory near one of your spaces, you typically will have to have a lot of workers that you can send to become shovels.
Right.
Pretty much every faction starts out with a rate of 3 to 1 workers to shovel. So it'll take 3 workers to shovel a terrain from one space on the dial that you have. And then you can increase that up down to just 1 for 1.
Right.
The next resource is gold. Gold is produced by trading houses, which is the structure that dwellings upgrade into. So you could call it like the tier 2 structure. Gold is used also to upgrade every structure, and it's used in both upgrading your shipping and your shoveling capability.
Right. And then the next one is your priests, which you don't start the game with any priests, unlike the workers and gold. But you get priests when you build your temples, I believe they're called. And your sanctuary. Yes. And priests, like we said, you can spend them on missions. You also use them to upgrade your shipping and shovel capabilities. And it should be noted that you can turn these resources into the next lowest one. So you can turn priests into workers and then workers into gold at a rate of 1 to 1, but you can't convert them upwards.
Right.
And then the final resource is power.
So power works a little differently than priests, workers, and money, because priests, workers, and money, you just collect them from the structures that produce them, and then you spend them to do your actions. Power is obtained slightly differently. Some structures produce it, but when you gain power, you don't necessarily actually gain it immediately. The way that power works is that every faction starts with 12 power tokens. And on a player's faction tableau, there's a space where you have three, we'll call them dishes. There are these three ovals that you store your power tokens in. There is a dish labeled 1, a dish labeled 2, and a dish labeled 3. And at the start of the game, you divide these 12 power tokens between those dishes in a certain way, depending on the faction. Normally, you put 7 power tokens in the second dish, and you put the remaining 5 in the first dish, but some factions have that a little differently. And whenever you gain power, you move them from dish to dish in a certain order. So the way that it works is you have to empty out all of the power from your first dish into the second one before you can start to empty out any power from the second into the third. So that means that if you started with like 7 power in the second dish and 5 in the first, and you were to gain 3 power, then you would have to take 3 from the first dish and move into the second. And then if you gain 3 more power, you would take 2 from the first, move to the second, and then you'd have a remaining 1. So you take that 1 from the second and move it to the third. Now, it works this way because you can only spend power when it's in the third dish. So you can essentially think of it like you have to gain double the power that you have in your first dish in order to start gaining actual power you can use.
Right.
Or you have to gain at least the amount in the first dish before you can start to gain power that you can actually use. Now, the ways that you spend power is also a little different. You don't use it to build anything or upgrade anything. You only use it either to convert it into resources. So you can convert 5 power into a priest, 3 power into a worker, or 1 power into a gold. But the other use for power is on the power actions on the game board, where you spend anywhere from 3 to 6 power to gain resources or shovels or build bridges. Specifically, it takes 3 power to build a bridge, 3 power to get a priest, 4 power to get 2 workers, 4 power to get 7 gold, 4 power to gain 1 shovel, or 6 power to gain 2 shovels.
Right. And again, those can only be used once per round by one player, and then they become unavailable for everybody else.
Right, those power actions. And it's important to know that when you spend power from the third dish, it goes back to the first dish. So if you have 5 power in your third dish, you spend, say, 3 of it on one of those power actions. If you would gain power next, you don't move things into the third dish yet, now that you have things back in your first dish. So you have to start emptying that out again. Now, the ways that you gain power,
Trading houses?
Yes, the trading houses produce power. Strongholds sometimes produce power. But the most common way to get power is when opponents build or upgrade structures adjacent to your own structures on the map.
Yeah. So when other players build or upgrade structures adjacent to your structures, you count the total strength, I guess, of the structures that are adjacent to the one that was just built. And you can spend a number of points to gain that much power. It's technically the strength of your structures is the power you get, and you pay points equal to one less than that. And when I say strength, on your tableau, when it shows the upgrade path for your buildings, there is a one power symbol next to the dwellings, a two power symbol next to the trading houses and temples, and three power symbol next to your sanctuary and stronghold. And so that combined is the strength. So, so if your opponent builds just a trading house or whatever next to a dwelling of yours, you can get one power for free, since that's one power symbol and it's one minus one for how many points you pay. If you have a stronghold, then it would be three power for 2 points, because the stronghold's power is three.
And if they build it next to a stronghold and a trading house, then that's a total of 5 power at the cost of 4 points.
Right.
Players start the game with 20 points. So from the start of the game, you can start to pay points in order to gain power. If you don't have any points, then you can't take this option. But we found, I think in most of our games, nobody's ever dropped to 0 points at the start of a game.
Right. And fans have affectionately called this leeching. So I'm going to be using that term during the strategy discussion a bit.
Yes. Let's see. What else do we need to talk about strategy-wise?
When you build a temple or a sanctuary, you get something called a favor bonus?
Favor tile.
Favor tile. And there are 3 of these for each element, and you can only get ones that you don't have yet, and they either increase your... or all of them increase your cult track standing of that element by 1, 2, or 3 spaces. But the 1 and 2 favor tiles have bonus effects, whereas the 3 element space favor tile doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
A quick rundown of these is fire 1, so the one that gives you 1 fire space, gives you 3 gold on your income during each turn. Water 1, I believe, is at the end of a round you get a point for each dwelling you have built.
No, that's you get 3 points every time you build a trading house.
Oh, that one's every time you build a trading house. Okay.
Yeah.
Then, do you want to go ahead and just read them off since you have them in front of you?
Sure. Earth one is you get 2 points every time you build a dwelling.
There we go.
Wind one is at the end of a round, depending on how many of your trading houses are on the board, you get a certain number of points. So at the end of a round, if you have 1 trading house, you get 1. If you have 2 or 3 trading houses built, you get 2. And if you have 4 trading houses built, you get 3 points at the end of that round. Moving on to the second tier. So fire 2, meaning when you acquire this favor tile, you move up 2 spaces on the fire tracker. This modifies how you found a town. Which we'll explain what that means in a second, but it essentially makes it easier for you to found a town. Water 2 is, it gives you a bonus action that allows you to advance 1 space on any cult tracker. Earth 2 gives you a new income bonus. It gives you 1 power and 1 worker for your income at the beginning of a round. Wind 2 gives you also an income bonus. It gives you 4 power for your income in addition to whatever else you earn. And then for 3, you don't get any bonuses. It's just advancement on the cult tracker. It should also be noted that there's 3 of each of those tiles. So it's first come, first serve. Only the first 3 players can get those. Again, you can't have duplicates. That is except for the third one, the third tier that advances you 3 space on a tracker. There's only 1 of those. So those are definitely first come, first serve.
Right. Now, on the cult track, when you send a priest on a mission, there are 4 spaces that your priest can go. There's 1 space for each cult tracker that advances you by 3 spaces on the track. And then there are 3 spaces on each of them that advance you by 2. And when you send a priest on a mission, it stays there, which lowers your maximum number of priests you can have. But it also means that if you take the 3-space advancement, nobody else can take it. Mm-hmm. And once you advance, I believe it's past the 3rd, 5th, and 7th point on the track, you gain power on each track.
Yeah, you'll gain 1, 2, or 3 power, depending on how high you've progressed on the advancement, on the cult tracker.
Yeah, once you get to the 10th spot, only one person can be on that spot. So if you get to the 10th spot, then you secure the 1st place bonus points.
Mm-hmm.
And you also get 3 power, I believe, when you go into the 10th spot. But there is a prerequisite to that, which is towns.
Okay, so towns. So you're building structures on the board, and you're probably building them adjacent to one another. These have to be directly adjacent, meaning that their hexagons are touching, or they have a bridge between them. They don't count when you have a river, unless you're playing the mermaids. Anyway, so if you get at least 4 hexagons next to each other with your structures built on them, and the total power of those structures, like we were talking about for the leeching rule section, is equal to 7 or more, then you found a town. So what that means is that you those adjacent, directly adjacent structures are considered to be a town, and you get to gain a number of bonus points plus some amount of bonus resources that is determined by the town tile you choose. So there's these 5 different town tiles. There's 2 of each, and each tile will give you a number of points and a resource. So, for example, if you found a town, you could choose to get 9 points and a priest. You could get 7 points and 2 workers, 8 points and 1 advancement on each cult tracker, 6 points and 8 power, or 5 points and 6 gold. So as soon as you found the town, which means you build the structure that connects all of your at least 4 hexes with a power of 7, then you get to choose and immediately place one of those tiles and gain its benefits. So that's a lot of points as far as points go, and a good amount of resources as far as resources go. And again, you have to found a town in order to get to the 10th spot on the cult tracker, which secures that you get 1st place on the cult tracker, which will give you bonus points at the end of the game. And again, it takes 4 hexes and a combined total of at least 7 points among the structures. Again, dwellings are 1 and others are 2 and 3. Now, we mentioned that one of the favor tiles reduces that requirement. It reduces it so you only have to have a power of 6. And then if you have built your sanctuary, then that will also reduce the requirements to only requiring 3 hexes directly adjacent to each other in order to make your town.
Right.
Okay, so let's see. I think there's only a couple things we have to talk before we can actually get into strategy.
Yeah. The last important thing that I can think of, at least... Well, okay, 2 important things. There's another bonus point thing, which is the largest indirectly adjacent chain of structures.
Yeah.
So this includes both the directly adjacent ones with bridges and directly adjacent buildings, and it includes your shipping value. And similarly to the cult tracks, whoever is 1st gets so many points, 2nd gets so many points, 3rd gets so many points. If there's a tie... then you split the 2 places that are being tied for. So, like, if one person's straight ahead but the other 2 people are even, then those 2 people split the 2nd and 3rd points combined.
Right. So those point values, I'll go over the point values for those and for the cult tracker. So the person with the longest connected group of indirectly adjacent structures gets 18 points. 2nd longest gets 12. 3rd longest gets 6. And then on the cult trackers, for each cult tracker, the person furthest ahead gets 8 points, 2nd furthest gets 4 points, and 3rd furthest gets 2 points. And those points are added only at the end of the 6th round after everybody has passed.
Right.
So we're talking about rounds now, and that leads me to the last thing that needs to be discussed, which is the round bonus, which is something that happens during the round and end the round, or at the end of the round, and it is... signified by a tile. These tiles are shuffled up at the beginning of the game and dealt to the 6 spaces to indicate the 6 rounds of the game. And each tile will have 2 parts to it. The part on the left is a method for obtaining bonus points during only that round of the game. So, for example, it might have a symbol that indicates that during that round only, for every shovel you produce, you get 2 points. Again, those are only active on the round the round that they are placed on. So if the second round of the game has that symbol, then only the second round of the game will you get those bonus points for making shovels. On the right side, they have another bonus that is counted at the end of a round. And those are usually determined by where people are on the cult tracker. So, for example, it might have a symbol that has two white cult tracker symbols and then an income of a worker. And that just means that for every two spaces that you've progressed on the wind cult track, you get a worker for the next turn. And there's different things for different amounts. Usually it's some anywhere from 1 to 4 increments on a cult tracker, and then some sort of bonus resource.
Cool.
All right. That's how to play the game.
Yeah, bit of a lengthy explanation.
It's a complicated game. For this one and for this episode, it's probably best that you actually go out and play it.
Yeah.
To really get a full understanding of what this game is about. All right. So now let's talk about strategy.
Yeah.
One very important strategy point. Oh, what's up?
I was going to say, so I did pretty bad for the few games we played at first, and I actually did some research on strategy into the game. So I want to give a shout out to Chris H. on Board Game Geek, who wrote a really interesting strategy guide that a lot of people seem to say was pretty good. So I'd check that out if you're interested in the strategy of the game as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just to speak really quickly to our experience with the game and how this game compares to similar games. In similar games, it's important to upgrade your structures because upgraded structures have a greater output of resources. But in this game, that's not the case because each structure outputs a different resource and different resources are needed for different parts of the game. And you need more of other resource of certain resources than other resources to be successful in this game. But when you upgrade a structure, you're upgrading it one for one. So, for example, a dwelling produces 1 worker, and when you upgrade it, that upgraded building will produce 2 gold, and then you upgrade it again, that upgraded building produces 1 priest. And having 1 priest is good, but it's more important to have lots of workers. And when you upgrade, you're removing that income from the board, so you're removing the ability to produce a worker and replacing it with the ability to produce money. In other games, you would upgrade a structure and it would get better. Like you'd build a thing that makes workers and then you'd upgrade it and now it makes more workers, or now it makes workers and it does this. And it's important to understand that distinction with this game because you need lots of workers and money to perform the different actions on your board in this game. And if you upgrade your structures too quickly, then you will not have success.
Right. And speaking to that point, it seems like only a few factions want to build their stronghold, maybe even at all during a game. For the most part, you want to like at least build up resources over the first 2 or 3 turns, or 2 or 3 rounds, I mean. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about points a whole lot, because if you have a lot of resources, you'll be fine getting points in the last half of the game.
Mm-hmm. The way that I managed to like come to a decent strategy with this game is you have to sort of picture it like one of those other similar games where you start out with a small amount of resources, a small resource output, but by the 6th turn of the game, you have a much higher resource output, and therefore you can do more actions. Similar games, this just happens naturally just by exploring the game and playing things and upgrading things. In this game you have to make more of an effort to achieve that end result of your civilization. So it's more important to be producing more and more resources every turn rather than like more premium resources.
Yeah. Quick note also is that you want to build your resource buildings close together, obviously, because the only way they'll actually give you points is to build a town out of them. And so when you're like placing your first buildings, plan on figuring out how you can expand outward from there,
at least to 4 hexagons, which yeah. is the requirement for the town.
And if you have like a shipping value and you use that to build sort of away from where your buildings are. Try not to do that too often and fork off too many buildings, mm-hmm. because then you're missing out on maybe getting an entire town built.
Right, which can be potentially 9 points, which is a pretty big sum of points.
Right, so
as far as this game is concerned.
Along with thinking of resources, in like how income works and all that, and building your economy, you really want to focus on how you can get the most points. This is kind of obvious, but like it might seem a little less obvious when you're playing the game how that works. The big thing I want to say is that the earth and the water favor tiles are really big, because say you get them in like round one or two, then for the next four rounds, if you're building up your economy, you're still getting points for doing so. Mm-hmm. You know, you're getting 2 points for building a dwelling, which gives you workers, and you want to build a whole lot of dwellings. So that might give you, like, 12 points over the course of the game from when you get it, or even more. Which is big.
Mm-hmm.
So
right, you start with 2 dwellings on the board, and you can build 6 more, but as you upgrade those dwellings, they go back into your supply so that you can build them again.
Yeah. So you're going to get a lot of points from those favorite tiles.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes it's good to go for an early temple for that. And this is especially the case if you can make the first round and second round favor checks at the end of the round. So like if you get well, I guess second round, because you don't really start with a priest, but if you get a priest for the income at the end of round one, and you send that and you can get like 2 workers from the end of round bonus,
right? Like it'll say like for every 2 stages you are on the fire tracker, you get a worker. So if you can get to stage 4,
yeah, if you can get to stage 4, then it's almost like you still had your dwelling, and mm-hmm. it produced 2 workers, you know. But in this case, you also are getting a lot of points in the future. So that's sort of how that investment can play out.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to not focus on the each round's like bonus points.
Yeah,
necessarily. It's good to get those bonus points when it also makes sense for your development. But like, for example, there's a bonus point thing that says you get 5 points for building your stronghold or your sanctuary. And if that's on the first or second round, ignore it, because you don't need those 5 points when it'll potentially ruin your economy.
Right, exactly. Let's see. So talking about the way power works, you generally don't want to spend power to make a priest or to make a worker, because if those can convert downward to gold at a rate of 1-to-1, the best like output for your power is to get gold. Also, mm-hmm. that it's much cheaper to build dwellings than it is to build trading houses, and so you'll probably run into a gold shortage earlier, which means any power you get from like leeching should probably be saved for gold. Now, mm-hmm. that being said, the spaces on the board are all pretty good. The notable ones, I think, are like 4 power for 2 workers gets taken a lot. But I think the most important one's 4 power for 7 gold.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Our dad won the last game we played, and he took that like 3 or 4 mm-hmm. rounds in a row.
I won the last game we played.
Oh, whoops. My bad. Okay, never mind.
But our dad did take that. I did take that one too, especially on the last turn of the game. I took that space. So prioritized it.
Yeah, so that's very important. Also, if you take 4 power for 1 shovel, then you're technically already getting a better rate on, you know, getting a shovel. Because, you know, normally 3 power is a worker, and at the start it takes 3 workers to make a shovel. So you can either spend what's essentially 9 power on a shovel or 4 power on a shovel.
Right.
And then 6 power for 2 shovels is an even greater payment, like an even greater difference in payment. Mm-hmm. It's much more efficient that way.
And the way that the board is set up, that typically any starting space that you're on is adjacent to 2 terrains that are only a single shovel away from being your terrain.
Right. And then those terrains are typically adjacent to at least 1 terrain that's, you know, at least 2 shovels away.
Yeah.
So those are really important to keep track of, and if you have the option to either, like, upgrade into a stronghold or to pass in its early game, just pass. Or even upgrading into a trading house, you know, you can pass, get the bonus card you want, and the next turn you can spend power on something you want.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you've already passed, you can leech, and leeching is generally really good.
So, you mentioned at the start of the game you should prioritize building structures so that they connect up and build a town.
Mm-hmm.
Do you also prioritize building structures where they're guaranteed to get some leeching?
Yeah, for sure.
Because right. You need to be next to your opponent's pieces for most of this game.
Especially because trading houses are significantly more expensive if they're not next to an opponent's structure.
Right. Upgrading a dwelling into a trading house will normally take, is it 2 workers and 6 gold? But if you're next to an opponent's piece, it only costs 2 workers and 3 gold.
Yeah. I think the more expensive side is based on what faction you have. Some it costs 6, some it costs 7. One of them, it costs 8.
Okay, so you mentioned bonus cards. These are, there's a number of them in each game, so that there's 3 left over after everyone's taken 1. And they usually give you some amount of income. Occasionally, they'll give you a bonus action. Just to go over what they do, one of the bonus, I'll just go over each bonus card and what it does. So, first bonus card gives you a priest on income. Next bonus card gives you a worker and 3 power. Next bonus card gives you 6 gold. The next bonus card gives you 3 power, and it increases your shipping range by 1 for that round only. The next bonus card gives you 2 gold, and it gives you a bonus action that is a single shovel. The next bonus card gives you 4 gold and a bonus action that increases your position on one of the cult trackers by 1 space. And then the next 3 bonus cards give you bonus points at the end of the round plus some amount of bonus resources. They give you, first one gives you 2 gold plus 1 point for every dwelling you have on the board at the end of the round. The next one gives you 1 worker plus 2 points for every trading house you have on the board at the end of the round. And then the third one gives you 2 workers plus 4 points for every having your stronghold or your sanctuary or both each at the end of the round. 4 points for that. Between these bonus cards, it seems like the good ones are the ones that have points. And I'd say the ones that increase your shipping or give you a shovel.
Yeah. Or the one that lets you advance gold on the favor track or cult track by 1 space.
Yeah.
Is also really good.
That one also gives you 4 gold, which is a good amount of gold. But yeah, advancing 1 space could mean getting like some amount of power, or the bonus. At the end of the game, it could just mean getting a ton of points.
Or the end of round bonus.
Right.
Right. Yeah, those are all good. The shipping one is especially good because there's a lot of factions that can start near a river, and then they only need 1 or 2 shipping power to build on another space, which means that you don't have to worry about shoveling for your next dwelling.
Right. Shoveling is expensive if you have to pay workers for it.
Yeah.
Even if you upgrade your shovel, it takes workers to have upgraded your shovel. And it priests. Does end up having a lower rate in the end. Like, you do end up saving workers by doing so. But it still takes a lot of time and effort to do that.
Yeah.
When you could be avoiding that altogether by, like you said, increasing your shipping range to just reach terrain that already matches your type just down the river. I think for the same reason, the income bonus or the bonus, what is it called? Bonus card that gives you a shovel for free is also pretty good.
Right. I wanted to mention something. So at the start of this game, you place your first dwellings in a snake order, where the first player places the first one, then second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever, and then the last player places their second one first, and then it goes counterclockwise. And then I believe it goes from the last player counterclockwise to pick the first bonus card, which you get the income of in the first route. So part of what's really important about placement is not only do you want to be next to other players, but you don't want to be next to players who can shovel the terrain that is 1 space away from yours with 1 shovel. So what I mean is, you know, you mentioned that If you shovel a terrain partially and you can't build on it on that turn, or you just shovel it completely and can't build on it on that turn, other players might have a chance to take it for themselves, and you want to try to place your starting buildings to minimize that risk. So, mm-hmm. like, if you're next to somebody else, try to expand away from them with that first building, so that the building that's away from them can't get taken from you, or that terrain right. that's away from them. You know, just look at the other players and look at, like, what the spaces that are, or what the terrain types that are one shovel away from their terrain are. And if one of those matches yours that are one away from you, or it matches your own terrain, which is probably the more important part, then try to avoid them.
Right.
Let's see.
I don't have any more. Just to make sure you're keeping track of where you are on the cult tracker and where everyone else is, because you might have to, like, push a little bit, like with a priest or something. You can't win purely by focusing on the cult tracker. You do need to also care about what's happening on the board, but you get a lot of points from that, and if you can secure multiple first place finishes on the cult board.
Yeah.
So just be aware of that and manage that while you're also managing your resources and your territory on the board.
Right.
Sort of a checklist of things that you need to complete by the end of the game is you want to make sure that you have the longest or second longest string of territories. You want to make sure that you're first or second in a number of the cult trackers. And you want to make sure that you have at least founded one town, in addition to collecting as many incidental points from bonus cards and from favor tiles as you can.
Yeah. I actually have read a lot of people say that getting two towns is more important than getting gotcha. One town. Like, that's what you should be aiming for when you're building up your cities, towns, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I think that's about it.
All right. So, game design.
All right. So, one good thing about this game is that each faction has, like, they have, like, their main difference with the stronghold, and they have their, like, passive, but for the most part, they operate pretty similarly, as in, like, you know, they're building the same buildings, which might have small differences in cost and output, but for the most part, they're pretty similar in terms of econ and stuff like that.
I'm pretty sure it might be the case where on any given faction board, there's like one side that's more normal and common, and then one side that's a little more different.
Yeah. And so what this means is that it encourages players to experiment with other factions just by not making it too much of an overload. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you can try out a new faction and be pretty assured that your first two rounds are going to be pretty normal and basic, and you don't have to worry about faction-specific stuff. There are obviously exceptions, like the Chaos Magicians that want to get temples earlier and stuff like that. But, mm-hmm. like, for the most part, they operate on similar axes. It also does have the benefit of, you know, it's easier for a player who's really well-versed in one faction but isn't well-versed in their opponents to, you know, be kind of aware of what the opponent is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everybody is building up their economy the same way and has similar goals, then for the most part, you know, you can react to what the opponent's doing or predict what actions they might go for. You know, there's not any faction that really cares about workers and gold in a completely different way to everybody else. So you can kind of be sure that, like, if they're low on gold, they might care about gold as much as I would in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a lot you have to learn about their faction specifically for how they play. Though, so as far as this game goes, I personally don't like the game right now, though it's really weird in that I want to play the game again. Every time I play the game, I feel kind of miserable, but I want to play it again to get better at it. Because I see...
Yeah, this game is definitely more of a bikes game than, like, anything else.
Yeah.
It feels like it's mostly just about like strategizing and math and then coming out ahead and winning at the end of the game. Yeah, there's not much chances for like the big moments or the storied moments. Like you could collect like a lot of resources, but in this game that doesn't lead to victory. Resources don't directly mean points.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Even building your economy doesn't directly mean points. Like the points, the places that points come from in this game are pretty different, and they're a little more removed from like the normal actions that you take in this game than other games.
Right. It's really weird because like the most common feeling I have during the game is like I could have done that turn a little better. Or I'm just a little short of the thing I wanted to do because I miscounted something. But at the same time, when I'm done playing the game, I'm like, next time I play, I won't run into that scenario now that I'm prepared.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you like a game that's a lot about like improving and mastering and understanding the game and how to play it, like this is a pretty good game for that. Like we played it 3 times, and every time our understanding of how to win completely evolved.
Yeah. The one thing I want to say is part of why it felt miserable during playing is this game leads to analysis paralysis really easily. Like we would have some really long turns, like everybody did. And I think part of that is because the resources are kind of connected in this weird web where like there's 12 different ways you can pay for any given action. And if you play it multiple times, you'll soon learn, like, this is the most efficient way to do this action. Or, you know, you don't want to spend workers on shovels as much as you want to spend power on them for the bonus actions. But, like, for a new player, there's so many ways you can spend workers and golden, especially power, because power can take the power actions. It can be converted into resources. There's a whole thing we didn't mention about how if you don't have enough power in bowl 3 or dish 3 to pay for something, you can remove power from dish 2 permanently, so it's not in your rotation anymore. And
you sort of burn power.
Yeah, and then you produce that much power into bowl 3 for this purchase. So like, if I need a worker, I could spend 2 power in bowl 3, and then 1 power from bowl 2 gets removed from the game, and I can spend that 1 power that's now in bowl 3 to make the 3 for a worker. But, like, because of this weird sort of multiplicativeness, how, like, everything's, you know, you have to count how much power you're getting, how much you'll need to spend on this, how you can divide that power most efficiently. If you're new to the game, it can be a whole lot to keep track of. Mm-hmm. And since there are a lot of things that are dependent on what other players do, like, you know, taking those actions on the board or passing certain things like being first in cult tracks or stuff, there's, you know, a lot can change when it comes back around to your turn, which, again, if you're not experienced to that system or that situation, then it can just really slow down the game.
Mm-hmm. One thing I find interesting about this game is that it lets you overplay, or in this case also overpay. It's sort of a term in Go, overplaying. It's when you try to do too much, or also you might just try to play too slow. And in this game, it lets you do that by, like, it lets you, like, every faction pretty much starts with enough resources to just upgrade a dwelling into their sanctuary or stronghold. So it just lets you do that, and that's kind of messed up, because if you do that, then you're kind of screwed for, like, the next few turns.
Yeah.
Like, you need the basic resources in order to build dwellings and upgrade them into trading houses, which are the most important resource buildings. But you can remove them from the board to build these like very expensive things, and therefore also like reduce your ability to rebuild your economy back from the lowest level. So in one case, that's a bad thing, because like somebody who's playing the game can just say like, oh, I have enough resources for this big, exciting thing. Shouldn't I build my big, exciting stronghold? That sounds awesome. No, you shouldn't. And unfortunately, you have to play out the rest of the game in order to really understand exactly why you shouldn't do that. But I guess it's another thing. It's like, it's kind of like, it doesn't hold your hand. It just says like, sure, if you want to, you can do that. And maybe somebody might find, or get some kind of pleasure in figuring out a strategy where they can upgrade to a stronghold on the first turn and then still end up winning, you know, right, depending on what faction they have. But it's interesting that that's there. It's probably not a good thing for a new player. But then again, this is a very complicated game. The kind of person that might come to this game in the first place probably isn't expecting the game to hold their hand and like gently say like, oh, you spent all your resources on this turn. That's no big deal. You'll have plenty of resources next turn to do what you really need to do.
Right. It feels like the type of game that has a high skill floor and a high skill ceiling. Because there's a lot of these, like, newbie traps, mm-hmm. Like upgrading your buildings too soon, for example, that, you know, an experienced player will figure out how to manage that. But, you know, I guess that's part of the appeal is it does have this high skill ceiling where you can keep learning and getting better at the game and optimizing.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with the power burning, or not power burning, but the leeching. You know, how many points is it worth it to sacrifice for power in this game?
Yeah, and I've seen people say you should always leech because the power is that useful.
Uh-huh.
But like, yeah, it does feel like a big thing where you kind of experience it and learn as you play. Or you can math it out beforehand and find, you know, the formula for when it's the most acceptable. But, like, it definitely feels like it's specifically geared, like you said, towards spiky players. It almost punishes the people that want experiences because of how strongholds and sanctuaries don't give you much early game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're these huge giant pieces that it would be so cool to place on the board, but their effects are minuscule.
Right. And I think personally, when I try to design a game that's like a really strategy, like engine builder sort of thing, I try to think about sort of the new player experience, because even if you have a game with a high skill ceiling, not everybody's going to want to pursue that if they don't enjoy their first few playthroughs. I think I'm like an anomaly in that even though I didn't enjoy my playthroughs, I want to play the game more. And whether or not that's necessary for every game, I guess it isn't necessary for every game. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of an understanding of how niche it's going to be in that case. Terra Mystica, sorry, had the benefit of releasing in 2012, which was sort of near the start of the board game renaissance. But if you were to make something like this today, I think you'd have to put more time into that new player experience.
Mm-hmm. Or you just have to understand like who you're marketing to, and you market the game like it's a complicated game, folks.
Yeah.
You know, on the little thing, ages X and up on the side of the board, mm-hmm. or side of the box. This one says ages 14 and up.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah, that's kind of fair.
Yeah. I think the board layout makes more sense after playing it the first time, mm-hmm. Especially the tableau. You know, you have like your terrain dial, and then next to that is the shovel upgrades. So, you know, that part makes sense as two things being connected to each other.
Mm-hmm. And near the shovel upgrades is the boat upgrade. So it's like two similarly functioning parts of the board are near each other.
Right. And then the way the buildings are laid out can be kind of confusing if you're not quite understanding how trading houses go into sanctuary or temples. Mm-hmm. But I think once you get that part down, and I mean, there's big arrows that show you go from here to here to here. Once you get that down, it's like that part of the board flows really smoothly. You know, the dwellings are what's closest to you. Though the fact that they're kind of far away from the dial is a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you want to make a player tableau, I think it's obviously big to make it intuitive and to make it flow well. What I mean is, like, when a player looks at a corner of their tableau, do they have to look at the opposite corner to make a decision? Or how often does that have to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you think about how much you can see of the board in your field of vision. And for, like, really heavy strategy games, you know, it helps to have a lot visible at once to make a full decision.
Yeah. I will say that you do have to kind of search to find the upgrade costs for shovels and shippings.
Yeah, they're pretty small.
Kind of small and tucked underneath certain visual elements.
Yeah.
Or tucked in between certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of the design of this game, like the visual and graphic design of this game, just kind of is a result of it being very early on in,
yeah, in
board gaming. And now, like, things are way more understood. If at least that's my opinion.
Yeah, I definitely agree. There's a couple other, like, parts of the graphic design that feel kind of outdated. But it's hard to really say how. Maybe
the,
like,
point tracker that goes around the edge of the board doesn't, like, end on a 5 increment in the corners.
Oh yeah.
That's, like, one thing.
Mm-hmm. Or, I don't know. It's hard to really put a pin to the aesthetic of the game and why it feels like a game from 2012 or why it felt like a game from 2008 for a while.
Visually, it's kind of cheesy. There's lots of, like, scrolls and borders and, yeah, embellishments that are kind of unnecessary. You know, the colors, they're very Catan colors.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Lots of browns mixed in with, like, just the basic color of the type of the faction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's lots of just unnecessary detail on these things. And I don't know. Some people like it, but it's definitely very busy. And you probably don't want too much busyness on something like a player tableau, where it's important to look at it and quickly figure out your strategy from your, like, available list of things you can do.
Yeah. Something that I wasn't a big fan of also was how much you can forget that you're playing as a fantasy race. This was, at least for me, like, there's some races that are very flavorful in how they work. Like, both of the mountainous ones rely on tunneling, I believe.
One of them does. I think the other one is something else.
Or, like, the Chaos Magicians involve the cult, or the mermaids go through rivers. But there's also a lot like the swarmlings or the witches that, like, it feels kind of disconnected from how their mechanics work. Which, it could just be me and how I prefer things to be tied with their mechanics more. At some ways, this game feels pretty abstract.
Yeah, I think this goes back to this is more of a spiky game than any other psychographic.
Yeah.
Because it's less about, like, the story that you're telling as you play the game, and more about just, like, managing resources and points and winning.
Yeah. It almost doesn't need that storytelling element or role-playing element, because that's not the player it's catered towards, yeah.
It's funny, too, at the start of the game, or at the start of the rulebook, they have this, like, small, like, little scene that plays out, some dialogue that's taking place between two characters from the game, that's just describing, like, a meeting amongst the Chaos Magicians. And they talk about how the witches are terraforming their terrain near their territory to match to the forest so that the witches can build there. And then someone, a wise Chaos Magician, speaks up and says, oh, that's okay that they do that, because then it'll be next to our stuff and we can get power. And then it just kind of ends there. And so it's like, it's kind of like there's really not, like, a way that the story tries to explain, like, your relationship with the other players. Like, you want to be near them, but you also want your own terrain, your own territory that you can carve out and build on. So it's not necessarily like your enemies, but you're not allies. You know, there's no real, like, story to understand there. You just kind of, you know, you just gotta go with it.
I think the whole, like, building near people is good, but also can be detrimental is a really interesting game design aspect. Like
that's a good point.
Yeah, like how, you know, you want to build next to people so that you gain power and you can upgrade your stuff cheaper, but it also means that they can gain power and upgrade their stuff cheaper, and it means that you might compete over one or two hexes. But, like, I think that's a scenario of, like, encouraging players to conflict with each other. So, like, if you look at, like, Scythe, there's not always a whole lot of a reason to compete with each other. You know, you might need to get to the factory or control one or two extra hexes to win the game or get that last achievement for killing somebody or beating somebody in a fight. But, like, there's not much else of a reason to actually, you know, interact with each other and start conflicts. But in Terra Mystica, the mechanics want you to be next to each other, and it encourages you to be next to each other. So even though you have this huge board, nobody wants to be in the corner and far away from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Which just leads to more interactions and spiky play.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. But it doesn't necessarily develop a narrative.
Yeah. But, you know, why is the bishop fighting alongside a knight? You know, it's an abstract game, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a little more abstract than other games.
All right.
All right. I don't have any more design notes.
I don't either. This is already a long episode.
Yeah, it is.
My dog needs to eat dinner.
Terraforming Mars is a similar game. Check that out if you're interested in a similar game.
I kept saying Terraforming Mars, so there you go.
Yeah.
Also, Tiny Epic Kingdom is like a simpler version of this.
Yes. All right. And so with that, that'll be the end of our episode discussing Terra Mystica. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. Hit us up with suggestions for games there. If you want to hear more episodes, you can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have everything categorized. If you want to find our episode of Terraforming Mars, you can find the tag for Terraforming Mars. That'll take you straight to the episode that you're looking for.
And our episode on Tiny Epic Kingdom.
In our episode on Tiny Epic Kingdom. If you don't see an episode on something that you're interested in hearing about, again, hit us up on social media with those suggestions. You can go to our TeePublic store via our website or by going to teepublic.com/user/bgbcast. That's where we sell our merch. And, of course, we have a Patreon.
Yes, that is at patreon.com/bgbcast. If you can support us on Patreon for $1 minimum donation, you can get a shout-out as well as ask us a question. We will choose up to 3 people per episode to shout out, and we'll choose one person to answer a question. You can ask us about games, board games, hobbies, other things, opinion, what our favorite food is, you name it. And I guess our shout out for now will be to our mom who supported us on Patreon. And for $5 a month, or minimum donation, you will gain access to our premium Patreon episodes. There are 2 Patreon series that upload on the off weeks of our main series, so the 2nd and 4th week of the month. One of which is Board Game Bros The Dusty Shelf, in which I review older board games that we don't normally cover on our main series. So, for example, the current episode that is up is over the game Uno. And next weekend, I'm going to have an episode on Scrabble, which is going to be pretty fun. And then also there is Board Game Bros Let's Make a Game, of which the 2nd episode I released last week, in which I make a game over the podcast and go over sort of the game design process, the brainstorming process, how to prototype things. And if you actually go on the post on the Patreon for that series, you can see some screenshots of the prototype and other behind-the-scenes info. So check that out. You can support us that way. The money goes to us and letting us make the podcast better and more and good. Yay. Cool.
All right, also, so with that, let's go to Matt Plugs.
Yeah, I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. Recently, I've been streaming at about 12:30 p.m. Central Time to 3 p.m. Central Time. I stream platformers, fighting games, platform fighters, exploration games, exploration platformers, roguelites, roguelite platformers, a whole bunch of different stuff. You can come check out my channel. You can follow me on Twitch. I also tweet out when I go live on my Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, so you can see updates there. Also, through my Twitch page, you can join a Discord server where you can talk to me, Jeff, and other fans of our work. And also, I write articles on the Episodes and Articles tab on the Board Game Bros website. I think the most recent article is still the Untitled Goose Game review that talks a bit about sort of genre and how Goose Game implements existing ideas in a new way. I think that game just got DICE's Game of the Year award for last year, so check that out, and it might give you some context as to why people like it so much.
All right, and I'm streaming too. Check out twitch.tv/radicalhawks on Wednesdays.
Spell that.
Dark Souls. Radical Hawks. Radical is in Radical Hawks, HAWKZ.
There you
all
go.
One word. So yeah, check that out. And that does it for end of the episode plugs. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
See ya.
I mean, not next week. See you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, that one. See ya.